inspiring interviews with today's top landlords.
This is the Rental Income Podcast.
And now, Dan Lane.
My guest on the podcast today is a rental property investor, and he also owns a property management company. And I think that puts him in a really unique spot because he can talk about what's working and what's not working for him, as well as for the properties he manages. He has some clients that are really successful with their rental properties and others that aren't doing so well. And I want to find out the ones that are doing well, what are they doing? What are they buying? What kind of neighborhoods are they in? How do they want their properties run in comparison to the people that aren't doing so well with their rental properties? So let's take a really quick break. We'll thank our sponsors. We'll come right back and we'll meet Lee Blackburn from Nashville, Tennessee. Being a landlord just became a lot easier thanks to Tenant Cloud. They have everything you need to manage your rental properties all in one place, from taking online applications to creating custom leases specific to your state and collecting rent online. And this is really cool. They actually have local contractors in your area to help you when you have a repair call. That's right, contractors in your area that are there for you when you need them. Everything is right there, all in one place. How much does it cost? Well, this is crazy. It's totally free to sign up. It's not a trial. It's free forever. They do have some paid plans, but it's totally free to sign up and get started. Just go to tenantcloud.com. That's tenantcloud, C-L-O-U-D, tenantcloud.com. The first step in buying a rental property is to get pre-qualified. And I would suggest you work with a lender that specializes in working with investors, because the last thing you want to have happen is to get to closing and find out the money's not there and you can't close. The lender that I recommend is Chaley Ridge from Ridge Lending Group. She's a nationwide lender, and she'll pre-qualify you for free if you mention Rental Income Podcast. Find out more today. Contact Chaley at ridgelendinggroup.com. That's R-I-D-G-E, lendinggroup.com. NMLS 42056. All right, now let's talk about management. So from what I've seen from my perspective as an investor, and I'm curious to see if you maybe see things differently as a investor and also a property manager, I feel like to have a successful portfolio, there's a lot of things you got to get right. You got to have good management, you've got to have the right tenant, and you've got to have the right property. This might be hard to answer, but is there one thing that is more important, or like one thing that you would say is the absolute most important thing you got to get right?
It's the very expected cliche item, and that is location. I think that trumps really everything, especially from a rental property performance perspective, because if you buy in the wrong location, it is absolutely going to negatively affect your bottom line, regardless if that property is the shining star of the neighborhood. If the location is bad, it's going to be difficult to attract the very high quality tenants that most should be looking for. And then, of course, that's going to lend to retention and property care and on-time rental payments and all the other things that do factor in to the bottom line starts with the location of the property. Absolutely.
That makes sense. I mean, you can't fix the location. I mean, you can always up your game on management or screen better. But if you have a bad property, you're kind of stuck with that. Have you seen clients you've worked with that maybe bought the wrong property and there wasn't really much you could do for them because the property was just going to be a problem?
Unfortunately, many times, yes. We see, and still to this day, we get calls from owners who have a property that's problematic for one reason or another. But generally, it does circle back to it's just simply in a bad area. But yeah, they call, you know, I get a very common implications of, well, I'm having a really hard time filling the vacancy, or I filled the vacancy, but now my tenant's not paying rent and calling me back. Or, you know, I filled the vacancy, but it seems like my tenants are moving out every 8 or 9 months. So, you know, there's a lot of circular activity that occurs as a result of that. And unfortunately, we do get those calls from distressed owners kind of looking, not necessarily for a way out, but certainly looking for assistance to get it restabilized. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, in some, if not many instances, it's just an impossibility due to the nature of the property itself.
Sure. Yeah. All right. Well, let me pick your brain about some of the things that you have seen work for property owners and some of the things that maybe haven't worked. And so, like, for the neighborhoods with location being so important, what is a good location look like? What should an investor be focusing on when they're looking for a good rental?
Yeah. So from a broker perspective, we use the term, a focus on crime statistics is the best qualifier or reference to location. People look at good schools. That's not always a make or break, especially in the Nashville market, mm-hmm. Which is where we are operating. But I think if you can boil it down to it's either a high crime area or not, that's really going to kind of tell the story that you need to know.
Right.
Doesn't have to be necessarily, you know, zero crime ever, high end type neighborhood. But if you do see, you know, if you do your due diligence and you find the crime stats to be exceptionally high or even above average, for a municipality, I would definitely steer clear, because in most cases, from my experience and perspective, you should be able to find something that's at least an average or better from a crime perspective.
Right. Okay. So in those high crime areas, do you just see more turnover? You know, maybe the tenants got their house broken into or their car gets broken into, and they just don't feel comfortable there. Like, a good tenant probably doesn't want to live in a bad area. Is that kind of what you're seeing, that it just like causes more turnover, or are you just attracting a tenant that's just going to be maybe more difficult to work with?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer is both.
Okay.
So we absolutely would see both of those examples. On the one hand, you have, you know, the people that know the neighborhood and that kind of know what's going on around there and kind of get into it, maybe with not the best intentions, perhaps, kind of knowing what they're dealing with already. And then, you know, they don't really feel compelled to honor their lease obligations, mm-hmm. Perhaps, you know, stay longer than the initial term, or take great care of the property, et cetera. But then you do have the folks that might be relocating to an area that don't really do their homework. The house might be great, and upon first glance, or, you know, a couple of glances in the neighborhood, it seems fine. Why would I look into it any further type question? They move in, and then they find out, you know, that they're hearing sirens all night long. And as you mentioned, perhaps a vehicle gets broken into.
Sure.
Or those types of things. And yeah, they just, they wake up one day and they say, why am I living here?
Right. Right. That makes sense. Now, what about the actual number of bedrooms in the property? Like, is a three bedroom the best kind of property to buy, or does it matter? Like, do two bedrooms in your experience rent quickly, or even one bedrooms, or maybe on the other side, four bedrooms? Like, does it matter how many bedrooms the property has?
Yeah. And I would say that might perhaps be a market specific question, but from my experience, as you noted, and in my primary market, it really doesn't matter. Three bedrooms rent, pretty much as easily as a two bedroom or vice versa. It really just depends on the overall demand on the product. We do find single family homes versus a condo type property do lease better. Retention rates are higher, et cetera, on the actual product type. But when you drill down the detail within the product, we do not find necessarily a leg up on a three or a four bedroom house over a two bedroom house. It just depends on the general demand component. I think from a resale perspective, I think, you know, a lot of people think the rule is a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house with a garage and a, you know, a small maintainable yard is going to sell better than the next. I have not seen that in direct experience.
Okay.
You know, like I said, I think, especially in my market, single family homes absolutely trump a condo type property for many reasons, which might be worth another call one day. But I think 2 versus 3 bedrooms really doesn't make that big of a difference.
And do you see more turnover? Like, you know, so they all rent pretty easily, but do you see more turnover? Because my impression, I don't own any 1-bedrooms, but my impression would be that you're maybe going to get a lot of people that are younger or earlier in their career, and maybe they're more likely to move. Am I right in thinking that, or not really?
You are, to a degree, absolutely. There is a fundamental level of transience with a quote unquote smaller property, and that's going to lend to the demographic that's living in these properties. So on the one hand, you know, a single family home with 3 bedrooms considered perhaps a larger house is generally going to attract perhaps a young family with school age kids. And we absolutely do see longer occupancy rates for that property type versus the 1-bedroom, you know, urban periphery flat that, you know, a guy right out of law school trying to get his legs under him professionally is going to live in, has easy access to downtown, maybe a really high end finish. And then, you know, life slash professional trajectory changes and, you know, he takes a job across the country. We do see more transience in the smaller type property. So, yeah, that's a great point.
Okay, awesome. All right, let's talk about budgeting for repairs. Like, this is something that, you know, I always think about, like, to make sure I'm putting enough money aside for stuff that's going to break or maybe even longer term stuff that's going to need to be replaced at some point. Like, from looking at your portfolio that you manage and also your personal experience, what do you think is a good amount of money to put aside for repairs?
Yeah, that's a great question. We generally tend to recommend to our clientele, and this is also a personal rule that I hold, is about $1,000 a year for basic routine, normal maintenance, and really in any given property. Of course, it certainly can vary by the size of the property. But generally speaking, I think if you have, you know, $1,000 budget per year, per property, that should be a pretty safe amount to keep on hand. And now obviously, you know, that does not really address larger ticket capital expenditure type items such as HVAC replacement or roof replacement. But for your basic leaky faucet, broken window lock type maintenance things that we see very regularly, I think $1,000 a year would be very, okay. I think it would be considered a conservative amount.
Right. Yeah. And I guess that's probably going to depend on the condition of the property too, right? That if the property is in really good shape, it might be lower, or if the property is in pretty rough shape, it might be higher.
Of course. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so, you know, my response there kind of factors around the notion that, you know, we manage an inventory at scale. So, you know, I tend to speak in statistical averages a lot. So sorry about that. But yes, of course.
Yeah.
You're going to have your contingent factors of, you know, what's the current condition of the property and the age of the property. Those will certainly factor in.
Yeah. Do you ever, like, have you ever had a client or a property that you managed where the owner maybe didn't have the property in the best condition?
Of course.
Yeah.
You know, 17 years in this business, I've seen it all, and that's certainly something that I've seen really more than I like.
Yeah.
Because ultimately it's not a fun scenario for anyone, but yeah, we have certainly seen and taken on properties that were in not necessarily disrepair, but perhaps had a higher level of deferred maintenance than I personally would be comfortable with. I'll kind of give you a quip that I had from a client a couple years ago that internally we got a pretty big laugh out of it. But First year or so of managing the property, it seemed that he had ongoing expenses for normal maintenance. Nothing was out of ordinary per se. Nothing technically was questionable, and it was really a lot of minor things that just simply needed to be done. And the comment was made, well, I've owned this property for 5 years now, and I haven't had to do a single one of these things. So why now all of a sudden that you're managing it, do I have to do these things? And, the obvious answer is, well, because you've obviously neglected your property for 5 years. Right. And we were able to have a very detailed discussion about that. And I think it was a scenario where, that particular owner, felt like he kind of put his foot in his mouth with that comment. But we do see it. And, I think preventative maintenance and ongoing maintenance, and in other words, not deferring that activity, is really critical to overall high performance rental
property. Sure. All right. Let me ask you a couple of questions about my portfolio. As a property manager, I think it'd be interesting to see what you think. So I don't like to raise rent. If I have a good tenant that always pays on time, doesn't cause any problem, when the lease comes up, I'll generally just renew them at the same price that they're paying. Do you think I'm leaving money on the table by doing that?
Probably a little bit, but you have to ask the question, does a small marginal increase make sense? Certainly financially to have a tenant leave. And the answer 99 times out of 100 is no. But then the other question that I think kind of gets pushed aside, and it's a little less tangible, is you go for that marginal increase. And in our market, we see, 2-3% annual increases is generally attainable. And we don't get significant pushback from tenants, but sometimes we do. And I think the corollary question that you should ask there is, for an additional, say, $30 to $100 a month in rent, and you all of a sudden give your tenant a really bad taste in their mouth, and perhaps they even subconsciously begin to take, less quality care of the property, or they pay their rent a couple of days later than they used to. And they are certainly now thinking, when the lease is up again, they're going to already potentially have one foot out the door.
Right.
So I tend to maintain a similar philosophy, and that is, if it's a great tenant, retain them, certainly at the cost of a marginal rental increase.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, to me, it's just not worth it. When you look at the cost of a turnover, that, there's always going to be some expense, and then you're going to have vacancy. And to me, it's not worth it for an extra $20 a month or $30 a month.
So, if you put that on paper, it does not pencil out from an underwriting perspective.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. All right. And then the other issue is kind of interesting. So I have a property that's in a homeowners association, and the president of the homeowners association sent out a letter the other day saying that he was he thought that the neighborhood was starting to go downhill a little bit, that there was trash around the neighborhood. And he was just basically yelling at everybody, telling them to step up their game and to make the neighborhood nicer. And, obviously I want the neighborhood to be nice too, but I have a property manager, and I didn't know how to explain that to the property manager in a way that they're going to be able to explain that to the tenant when there's nothing specific that the tenant is doing wrong. How do you think I should approach that with my manager?
Well, I think that's a fairly direct response, and that is assuming that you have detailed HOA rules and regulations formally attached to your lease and part of the lease itself. I think it's just a simple reiteration of the tenant's obligation and responsibility to the lease to be adhering to those rules and regulations.
Yeah.
That's a fairly straightforward process. Unfortunately, and I don't know how much of this you want to hear, but around our marketplace, We hear regularly from HOA managers, you know, well, this neighborhood has so many rentals in it, it's just getting run down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's a terrible qualifier. You know, we always, the tongue in cheek comment is, you know, renters are people too. And you know, I never really understood the notion of, you know, why renters versus buyers should have any disparity.
Right.
They're both entities that are living in a home and paying their bills. So, you know, what structural difference does it make? And I do understand the notion of, you know, renters may not have the pride of ownership and the correlated care of the property. But at the end of the day, if you have qualified and vetted your renter to the extent that I feel you should be, they're going to be responsible, upstanding people that are going to honor their lease contract and take good care of the property. So it shouldn't really matter.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't want the tenant to feel like the manager was coming down on them when, like, you know, it's like the HOA didn't say anything specific that's wrong with the property. And, you know, I don't know if the tenant is keeping the property up or not, but I don't know. Maybe the HOA just would have been more specific and address actual specific problems than just coming out of the general.
That would definitely be helpful. But I think, you know, and let me just say, if I were faced with the same scenario, I would simply ask my manager, be very gentle and kind. Mm-hmm. Please reach out. It doesn't have to be formal. Certainly not, you know, anything written and sent in the mail. Perhaps an email would suffice, but just a very soft approach. And I would put it back on the HOA management and say, look, HOA is going around. They're harping on things. Certainly, you know, don't take this as in any way accusatory. But, you know, it is simply my obligation and responsibility as the property manager of your home that we kind of trickle down, you know, the HOA sentiments here and just let you know to please be vigilant if, number one, you're seeing anything on your own property that perhaps shouldn't be occurring. But, you know, even if you see other people, let's just all work together to maintain the character and the quality of the neighborhood. And I think you can do that gently enough where it would not come across as accusatory in any way. Yeah. I think it's just how you approach it.
I think you're right. Well, if anybody is interested in investing in the Nashville market, you've got a pretty unique business model where you actually help investors find properties, help them fix them up, and then you manage them. Tell me a little bit about how your business works.
Yeah, it's full life cycle, buy, hold, acquisition. So on the acquisition side of things, we provide all of the intel in terms of the physical property itself. Of course, anything that we would represent is only going to be in our target locations, which of course are tried and true. We know the very best ones in terms of demand metrics and retention metrics and everything that goes into it. We can send in our crew right away to give a rent ready estimate, which generally are hard estimates. Once approved, we can tackle the project, which we would manage in its entirety. We go straight to the leasing platform. Once the property is rented, then we go into full cycle management. And then, you know, with any luck, you reach your exit point at which time you might be interested in selling. And of course, we can list and sell that property for you as well. And in fact, we have obviously a fairly large investor network. And oftentimes, if a property is rented or not, we would have really good history and data on the performance of a specific property. And of course, we're going to know it physically inside and out very well. But a lot of times we can just flip it over to another investor client that we might already have. And it makes for a very quick and certainly smooth process.
If anybody wants to connect with Lee, I've got his contact information on the website. You can find it at rentalincomepodcast.com/episode298. I'd like to thank today's sponsors for making this episode possible. First, I'd like to thank Tenant Cloud. If you're looking for online applications, online leases, online ACH payment, check out tenantcloud.com. They have a bunch of different packages, but you can get started for free today at tenantcloud.com. I'd also like to thank Chaley Ridge from Ridge Lending Group for making this episode possible. If you're looking to buy a rental property, whether it's your first property or you want to add to your portfolio, reach out to Chaley Ridge. She is a nationwide lender, and she specializes in helping investors buy rental properties. She has a ton of different loan programs, and she can find something customized to you for your situation. You can find out more at ridgelendinggroup.com. That's R-I-D-G-E, lendinggroup.com. If you mention Rental Income Podcast, she will waive all the pre-qualification fees. NMLS 42056. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe. We have new interviews every single Tuesday. And if you subscribe, you'll get notified as soon as they come out. My name is Dan Lane, and this is the Rental Income Podcast.